American Public Media.
I haven't asked you to do this up to now, and I wonder if you would give me your 1-3 sentence explanation of string theory.
Oh, people ask me to do that all the time.
Can you do that?
Well, I can make the attempt.
Okay.
If you look at physics from the time of Isaac Newton, all of our physics is predicated on a simple belief. That is, if you could understand the rules of billiards and how the balls bounce around and move, you could understand everything about the universe. Now, this may sound like a very strange statement, but you see, when Isaac Newton wrote his great equation that drives essentially all of classical physics, what he had in mind was a little ball. It's something we physicists call a geometrical point particle. So just think of a little ball and try to figure out how it moves.
Mm-hmm.
That's what his equations actually do. They tell us how little balls move. And if you apply those ideas over and over again, you find out that eventually you can get to the moon. You can figure out how to plot the paths of cannon shells, which, you know, okay, at a certain point is not something we should hold up with great pleasure or pride, but nonetheless, it's a useful thing to know in the world.
So you have to know what kind of force to apply and what
exactly,
how things behave to
and how
make
things
them
respond.
And do so, what you want them to do.
Right. So the model for all of that work is that the universe can be understood in terms of little balls.
Okay.
Now, this idea actually gets elaborated in a certain kind of way by Einstein. He just sort of changes the stage upon which the little balls exist. It is modified yet again by quantum mechanics and quantum theory. We've talked about that. But again, little balls actually play a role in quantum theory, but in a very subtle way. And so if you look
so
at
in,
all
in
of our
quantum theory, they don't necessarily go where you think they're going to go, right?
Which is that's exactly right. The more technical term is that in quantum theory, there's something that describes how little balls can sometimes behave like waves.
Right.
And this something actually depends on little balls. That's one way to think about
right.
it.
Okay.
Okay. So all of our physics we got for a couple of hundred years by thinking about little balls. Well, you see, this idea of little balls also ran us into a problem. We could not understand how gravity and quantum theory work together if the universe is based on the idea of little balls. And so string theory is a very simple statement. Forget the little balls, replace them by little strands, little filaments, or as I sometimes say, little pieces of pasta.
Huh.
Because if you do that, just as Einstein talks two stories, the one about traveling at the speed of light or the other one about falling, leads to equations. If you replace the balls in Newton's thoughts by little strands, you get string theory.
Another analogy that I don't know where I read this in something of yours or someone else, that these are finite curves is another way to think about these strings.
Yeah.
So that would mean that the effects that Einstein, the kinds of laws of physics where something, you know, you throw a ball and it goes in the direction you throw it, that could be true at some level, and also that at the quantum level, the movement might not be what you expect, but if you had a curve joining them, then you could still imagine the laws at work?
Well, it doesn't quite work that way.
Okay.
No. Strings are intrinsically quantum mechanical in nature. So, at some deep level, we can never quite ignore their quantum aspects. But the thing that they bias, which we never could understand, at least we have not been able to understand so far, is if the universe is quantum at the smallest level, mm-hmm, that is, has all this weirdness about it, and if the universe is one where gravity is described as Einstein gave, how can these two things be consistent?
Mm-hmm.
As long as you stick to a little ball viewpoint, the answer is they can't. But as soon as you switch to spaghetti or pasta, the answer is they can.
Okay. That's probably as much as I can grasp. Thank
well,
you. I mean, you know, and having said that, it's thrilling, you know, even just the terms that you use about to describe, you know, multidimensional vibrating strings, I don't, you know, with the finite curves. It's very intriguing. I think that.
Well, the language around string theory is certainly colorful, to say the least, but that's sort of true in general about theoretical physics. you know, we earlier talked about this idea that there are these pictures that we physicists have.
Mm-hmm.
For us, you see, there's an analogy, another analogy I like to give between music. You know, in music, we have musical scores, or you can play the scores on an instrument, right?
Right.
Both of these things are music. The score is music. The performance is music.
Hmm.
Well, for us physicists, you see, there's the mathematics. That's physics. We're using the mathematics to describe some aspect of the world. But there are also these pictures that we have in our heads about what the mathematics is describing.
That's very helpful.
Now, before computers, it was very difficult to get these pictures in front of other people. But you see, computers are to mathematics as pianos are to scores. Namely, computers are devices for playing mathematics. That's what people do. That's what you do when you go to see The Lord of the Rings or Spider-Man. Those images that you see on the screen are enormous numbers of equations running across the screens.
Mm.
So computers are perfect devices for playing mathematics like music.
That's wonderful. And I'm assuming that string theory is also elegant and beautiful, these values that were so important to Einstein.
Well, certainly for those of us who work on it. I mean, you know, I when I hear the sort of non-scientists sort of say those words about us, I always think I hear a bit of a chuckle in the background.
No, I've actually interviewed enough of you scientists to really have reverence for that, for the way you use those words.
Well, I'm not sure you should have reverence, but but often I hear a chuckle because, you know, it's like, what are these people talking about? Beauty and elegance.
Elegant spaghetti.
Right. So I have a story that I try to get the point across, and it goes, imagine a planet on which there was no sound at all. Could music exist on such a planet? Well, you might first be tempted to say no. But let's assume that creatures live on that planet that are about as intelligent as we are, and that for whatever reason, some small number of them come to create scores, musical scores. So what do? Well, they'll be called the musicians, obviously, and they'll be talking about the beauty and the power of these symbols on paper. And most of their fellow creatures on the planet will look at them and say, gee, what in the world are these, what are they talking about? You see, that's what it's like to be a theoretical physicist here, because for us, having access to the mathematics means we read scores.
Hmm.
But real musicians who read scores, I'm often told, can actually, in some sense, hear the music in their mind.
Right.
And so that's what it's like for us, and that's why we use the words like elegance and beauty, because in some sense, we're like those musicians on that planet with no sound. We're the only ones who have access to that kind of beauty.